solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You're not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
Well, one thing that happens when you're in a hyper-growth company like Google that has these very audacious goals is that life on a rocket ship can be difficult. Let's put it that way. So stress levels are high, conflict can become exacerbated, you know, all of the kind of natural human challenges and emotions that we feel in the course of life and work are magnified in a situation in which you have these kind of high growth, hyper growth companies. So I think at Google, you know, people were interested in finding solutions to be resilient and remain agile. And they started to look primarily at the neuroscience around this. And one of the things that the neuroscience started to point to was that there is a way that you can train your brain with a set of useful mental habits to help promote focus and mental clarity and mental stability in the face of many challenges. And the shorthand term for this would be mindfulness.
Welcome to the 41st Conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. This is a series of reflective conversations with leaders across disciplines on topics around leadership, transitions, and careers. I'm Deepak Jayaraman, your host and curator of the podcast. I'm an executive coach, and I work with leaders and help them play to their unique potential. To know more about my leadership advisory work, you might want to visit the About section at playtopotential.com. I believe that just like businesses need to be coherent about their answers to where to play and how to win, we all need to be thoughtful about our responses to the two questions, where to go and how to grow, as we go through our journeys. This podcast is an attempt at exploring how some leaders across domains have grappled with these two questions as they've gone on their respective journeys. In that context, I'm excited to announce my guest for this podcast, Dr. Rich Fernandez, CEO of Search Inside Yourself Leadership Institute. To provide some context, Search Inside Yourself was a course that was conceptualized by Chade Meng Tan, whose job title, interestingly, at Google was Jolly Good Fellow. Meng curated wisdom from various fields and was instrumental in putting a course together for Google, which he called Search Inside Yourself. This was for Googlers to enable mindfulness and happiness for them to perform effectively at work. But given the success within Google, he set up a not-for-profit Search Inside Yourself Leadership Institute. SIYLI has done mindfulness and emotional intelligence work with leaders across 100 cities in 30 countries so far. Coming back to Rich, he was heading executive development at Google before he became the CEO of SIYLI. In our conversation, we spoke about his insights on leadership development from his days at Google, but we quickly moved on to talk about some of the elements of the Search Inside Yourself program, including how we should think about mindfulness, attention, and meta-attention, as he explains it, resilience, happiness, and more. At some level, given the nature of business challenges that we all are grappling with, the answers have to be found a few levels deeper within ourselves. While there's a lot of this type of content out there, what really struck me was the amount of research that had gone into the design of the program and how they've taken best practices from a range of people, including Tibetan monks, and have vetted different approaches with data to pick the ones that make sense. Without further ado, over to my conversation with Rich.
Rich, thank you so much for making time for the Play to Potential podcast. Really excited to be talking to you.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I'm very happy to be here.
We'll talk about Search Inside Yourself in a minute. But before that, I'd like to talk about your insights from your days at Google, where you were heading executive development. I'm curious about leadership development in the digital age, if I may use the term, as compared to how traditional economy companies think about it. What are the big differences in terms of the key levers that are different in the digital context versus the industrial context, if one may frame it that way?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. As many of you know, I've led the function at Google that was looking after executive development, executive education for the senior leaders at Google for a number of years. I left there some years ago, but what I saw then and what I still see now, especially compared to, I guess, more traditional companies or economies, is that in the digital economy, disruption and innovation happens at a very, very quick rate. And accordingly, leaders need to be agile to meet that kind of disruption. So that when we talk about leadership development and growing the leadership capabilities of people, it's really about how to help them meet those disruptive challenges in an agile way. So what's different about leadership development is that there are no simulations, there are no long-range strategic plans that are going to effectively address the dynamics of a highly disruptive marketplace. So if you think about it, for example, 10 years ago, Uber, or if you're in China, Didi, you know, these things didn't really exist. And now they are major players and major drivers of a digital economy, shared economy, at least. And so how do you kind of meet those challenges? What we found is that in order to help people stay agile, we really had to help them think about things like very effective cross-functional collaboration, the ability to kind of map and navigate relationships quickly so that they can get things done across lines. And in fact, it's much more of a matrix organization than it is really kind of a vertical organization. People like to talk about vertical integration a lot, but really it's a lattice or a matrix of a web of relationships that need to work really effectively so people can go quickly and meet disruption as it occurs. So what we don't see often in this context when we do leadership development are things like business simulations. You know, I used to work for more traditional economy companies, financial services companies. And in those types of environments, business simulations were great. At a place like Google, it doesn't really mean much because a year, 2 years from now, who knows what the business landscape really looks like. So why even try to model it? So again, developing.
And one hears about, let's say, education, exposure, and experience as three levers, right? Depending on the kind of behavioral change you're driving at. Are there, let's say, the key dimensions along which you think about developing leaders in a place like Google?
Yeah, you know, certainly, you know, the education piece is important so that they have the threshold capabilities. But we also look for, you know, domain expertise or leadership. And then I think the third pillar that's really not so well understood outside of Google is something called Googliness. So this is a quality of being able to interact and relate to your peers, you know, to people who are around you on other teams as well, in a really kind of open, agile, warm way. Maybe not warm necessarily, but just it's a quality of being able to work effectively across the organization. And it's something that a lot of companies don't really understand and don't really assess for.
And do you codify that within Google? Do you sort of spell out what Googliness means?
Yes, to some extent, but it's more like a criteria that we filter for. And you kind of know it when you see it as well. So you know if this person is going to be a good collaborator, not so territorial, but much more of a good collaborator. You know, obviously they have the threshold intelligence, they have the threshold domain expertise, but then what are their attributes around, you know, effective relationship? And that is something that's not very well known outside of Google or even really understood in a lot of companies, in my opinion. A lot of companies are just trying to hire the best expert in the field and they don't look for other quality.
Just segueing to a related theme, Rich, in the context of defining potential of a leader, I'm curious about how you think about that and more specifically, you know, like you said, you know it when you see it. How do you see the different inflection points as you rise to the top in Google, let's say director to VP to the next level? You know, what shifts in each of these points?
Well, you know, in a environment, tech environment, usually at the time I was at Google there, when we look at directors, those are essentially the highest unit of execution within the organization. So their role is still responsible for lots of execution. And then we get into the VP and above, and it becomes much more strategic, you know, driving a lot of the kind of innovation for the future and so forth. I like to think about potential in terms of really three things. And this comes out of a pretty robust body of research from the Corporate Leadership Council. I think they did a study, I don't know, a while ago now, where they looked at, I think, something over 10,000 employees across 15 different industries, 29 different countries. And they found something fascinating about potential. And what they found was that oftentimes we mistake high performance for potential. But what they found was that in 71% of the time, people who are high performers were not high potentials.
Wow.
But that conversely, something like 93% of high potentials are also high performers. So that's a little bit, if you just think about that for a second, right? So roughly 70% of high performers do not have the potential to go to the next level. They're really good at the position they're playing, but that doesn't mean they're going to be a great leader. But when you can identify those people that are high potential, chances are they do have a track record of success. And in fact, that research and some other organizational research, you know, from Google and other places, have suggested that it's things like agility, which is the willingness and ability to take on new roles at greater complexity and so forth. Promotability, which is the ability to kind of step to the next level and lead through that next inflection point. And then finally, a track record of success. That's the performance piece. If you combine all three of those, chances are very high that you're looking at someone who's high potential.
Got it. Got it. And from a development perspective, Rich, in a tech context, you spoke about agility a couple of times. How do you move from figuring out what the area of development is to really changing behaviors? What have you seen work effectively in a Google context in sort of moving from cognition to behavioral change?
You know, Google and a lot of other tech companies are data-driven places. And so likewise, in terms of leadership behaviors, you want to look at the data. So there was a very useful tool called Upward Feedback, where all of the direct reports of, let's say, an individual leader would give feedback formally on a survey to a specific leader. And that would form part of their performance reviews. So it's very easy to see how effective they are being as a leader, and then being able to use that data to point to key areas to then grow and develop. And when you get onto the develop side of things, because there's the assess part of it, which is the gathering the data, and then there's the develop part of it. When you get to the development piece of it, it's really about giving them the right coaching, the right environment to talk to their peers. And so when we used to talk about coaching at Google, we also talked about peer coaching. We'd set up forums for that to happen. And then also just getting the right type of learning around leadership, like what attributes of leadership are they needing to grow? Is it emotional intelligence? Is it adaptive leadership, stakeholder management, more effective negotiation? Then you have specific solutions that you can ensure that they're connected to once you've assessed, you know, what are the specific areas to work on.
And those solutions would be courses or MOOCs or those kinds of things, or would it be experts?
All of the above. Blended learning, peer learning, in-person learning, you know, it's the full spectrum, one-on-one coaching. So it really is a full spectrum of development that is available to them.
Got it.
Yeah, it's investing in your talent. You know, I mean, it's, you can't just say to people, you know, you need to do better at this. You actually need to support them. You need to provide them the scaffolding. And that's everything from an app all the way through one-on-one executive coaching.
Very interesting. And maybe flipping sides from a career management perspective, again, you operate in the Valley. I'm curious about the notion of staying relevant, right? Given the velocity of change, how do people in the Valley stay relevant? You know, what do you see them do effectively when you look at people that have sort of reinvented themselves multiple times? What are some of the meta themes that play out?
That's a really good question. How do you stay relevant? You know, I think the domain expertise, the technical skills are critical, but as you start to kind of grow as a leader, are you able to then harness the team around that technical capability and help them move through a set of disruptions and work through, you know, different models together? So if you think about a specific unit, let's say something like Google, let's talk about Chrome and Google Fiber, right? Like, how do those two play effectively together? It's not enough to be a great player at the browser, but you have a partner here who wants to create, you know, high speed internet. And so how do you kind of partner together effectively? I think when the leaders start to demonstrate those capabilities to build these collaborations across functions, they start to develop expertise that's beyond their single domain that they're known for. And they can become sort of leaders with more transferable skill sets that they can then take, you know, kind of to another venture, potentially, if they were wanting to reinvent themselves. Basically, what I'm saying is it is important to have deep expertise, but you also have to have horizontal expertise and the ability to play across function so that you can, you know, kind of potentially move to a different place and effectively work in that that adjacency.
Got it. Let's move to the book, Search Inside Yourself. Rich, if that's okay with you, and to the organization. I read the book by Meng with a lot of interest. Would love to explore a few themes, but before we dive in, I'd love to get a sense of the origins of the program. Where all does it draw from, and give us a sense of the why behind the program and some of the foundational pillars of the program.
Right. Well, one thing that happens when you're in a hyper growth company like Google, that has these very audacious goals, is that life on a rocket ship can be difficult. Let's put it that way. So stress levels are high, conflict can become exacerbated, you know, all of the kind of natural human challenges and emotions that we feel in the course of life and work are magnified in a situation in which you have these kind of high growth, hyper growth companies. So I think at Google, you know, people were interested in finding solutions to be resilient and remain agile. And they started to look primarily at the neuroscience around this. And one of the things that the neuroscience started to point to was that there is a way that you can train your brain with a set of useful mental habits to help promote focus and mental clarity and mental stability in the face of many challenges. And the shorthand term for this would be mindfulness, using the skills of mindfulness. Now, this is based on neuroscience, the actual working of the different networks in your brain. And one thing they found in neuroscience in the past couple of decades is that the set of skills called mindfulness skills, which have a lot to do with attention and directing of attention, awareness and perception, and then self-regulation and management, which then also spills into relationship management in the interpersonal sphere. All of this can be trained and in the brain. And the brain actually will change once it starts taking up these mental exercises. Again, this might not be surprising. I mean, you know, I think this podcast, of course, is going out in India, a place where pretty much mindfulness was invented. So this is probably may not be news for folks there. But the sort of empirical neuroscience of it is fairly new, at least in the West. And so what they were interested in Google was looking at the ways that these mental skills change the brain and prepare you for the kind of environment in which you find yourself and help you succeed in that environment. So search, as in search, like Google search, but inside yourself was born. Search Inside Yourself, that's the name of the curriculum, that really then combines the skills of mindfulness together with neuroscience and emotional intelligence as the outcome. Because what we realized is people aren't so interested in doing a stress buster as much as they are in developing a new kind of intelligence, which was emotional intelligence. And so SIY, Search Inside Yourself, is a mindfulness-based emotional intelligence curriculum that was developed specifically for initially for Google engineers and then broadly for the Google population. Mm-hmm.
And today, talk to us a little bit about the mission at Search Inside Yourself. Now, clearly, it's set up as an independent entity working with organizations around the world.
So yes.
For the purpose of the listeners, give us a sense of what's the vision here.
Yeah, well, so we started seeing, as we rolled this curriculum out, we started seeing tremendous success. So thousands of Google employees were going through it every year. And it occurred to us that, you know, there could be a great benefit. We started getting a lot of requests from other organizations to offer this to them. And so, you know, we had a conversation with the head of HR, my boss at the time, a man named Laszlo Bach. And we agreed that there would be a way that we could create a separate nonprofit organization called Search Inside Yourself Leadership Institute, or SILI, SILI.org. And its mission would be to offer this curriculum to the world, in effect, to make mindfulness and emotional intelligence practical and accessible, and really take this approach of science-based and evidence-based tools to help people thrive. So, you know, some 6-7 years ago, we rolled the Institute out of Google as a separate standalone nonprofit organization and began offering this broadly to the world. We still share the IP with Google. This curriculum is still run within Google every year. Again, still thousands of employees take it, but now other organizations through the Search Inside Yourself Leadership Institute can also experience the curriculum for themselves.
Got it. And in the book, Meng talks about a few types of attention, right? One is the distinction between attention and meta attention, and mm-hmm. the other was the difference between open and focused attention. So I was curious with these distinctions, could you talk a little bit about what these are, and more importantly, you know, why should we be cultivating some of these different types of attention?
Mm-hmm. Attention is simply the directing of your mental faculties to an object of focus or attention. And so this is something we all of us do every day. But something that was found in the research is that about half the time, 47% of the time, our minds also wander away from what we're doing. So though we may be focused on something specific, we also get distracted quite easily, on average about half the time. And so meta attention is, if attention is the quality of directing the faculty of attention or focus, meta attention is becoming distracted and then knowing that you're distracted. So in some ways you could say it is attention of attention. Knowing when your attention has wandered, knowing when your mind has wandered, and then bringing it back to full attention. So that's the difference between attention and meta attention. Focused attention is direct attention, is that quality, like I said, of focused, directed attention. But when we talk about focused attention in the book and in our curriculum, we talk about it as a skill that you can develop. And there's a set of exercises you can use to cultivate it. And that is simply, it's very similar to meditation. You could sit and watch your breathing, for example. And we use the breathing as an object of attention when we're cultivating focused attention, because it first of all, it's available to everybody. And you don't have to believe in anything to focus on it. And so you can focus on your breath. And studies have shown that when you do focus on your breathing, you activate the attentional networks in your brain, the direct attention networks in your brain. Mm-hmm. And so focused attention is an exercise to cultivate sustained attention over time. And open monitoring, as you pointed out, is a slightly different exercise. There is a quality of attention there, but it's not directed at a single object. It's actually kind of opened up and directed much more broadly. That's much more about noticing the perceptual field. So mm-hmm. allowing yourself, for example, to simply notice what you notice. I'm not speaking in riddles here. I'm just trying to explain what it means to like notice your own perceptions. That is open monitoring. So what are you thinking in this very moment? What are you feeling in this very moment? What might physically you be experiencing in this very moment? Your attention moves to all of these different factors throughout, as you know, moment by moment, second by second. So becoming aware of how your attention is shifting and moving is the process of open monitoring.
Very interesting. Very interesting. And back to meditation, Rich, you know, the people I interact with, in general, conceptually, everybody knows it's helpful, right? And quite a few even get started with it. But I think the biggest slippage or leakage I see is over the medium term, right? People struggle to make it a habit. What's been your experience in installing this as a habit for the long term in people?
Mm-hmm. What I would say is ritualize it and routinize it. So make it a ritual or a routine. So personally, for me, it's the first thing I do when I wake up. I literally get up from bed, splash some water on my face, and I go downstairs to my office, and then I sit in the morning. And this is early morning before the sun is up. I'm an early riser. And before my family is awake, before I check my email or open up, you know, the laptop or look on my phone or anything, it's the first thing I do. And then the second thing I do is I brush my teeth. So it's to that level of routinization, right? It's to that level of ritualization for me. It's just the hygiene factor, I call it. So to the extent you could make the formal practice of meditation a hygiene factor, it will help make it a habit in your life. The other suggestion I have is something we offer in our curriculum, which is make it a set of integrated practices. When people mm-hmm. think about meditation, they think about having to do exactly what I just said, which is set aside, you know, X block of time and, you know, sit in a certain way and close your eyes and protect this space for formal practice. But there's also a way to practice mindfulness and meditation in an integrated way. So for example, as you move through the course of your day, integrate it into your day. Between meetings, you know, if you need to walk to the restroom, make that a walking meditation. I'm actually serious about that, right? Become aware of your body as it moves through space between your office and the restroom. Become aware of your footfall. Become aware of, you know, the felt sense of your body. How are you feeling actually in that moment? Or take the opportunity to focus on breath, or this being in India, this podcast, you know, if you have a mantra that you're, you know, that you're familiar with or particularly like, use that. And I say mantra, and there's often a religious component to that. But here, what I'm referring to is really finding an object of your attention to train your attention upon it. Whether it be mantra or breath or walking or sensation, you can really do this throughout the course of your day. I was driving to work today and I was focusing on my breath, not so much so that I wasn't able to drive, but when there was a red light, when I was stopped in traffic, in and out for three breaths, I noticed my breath. Next stoplight, same thing. Integrated practice is also a helpful one.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. This segment reminds me of a recent conversation I had with Dr. Ramachandra Guha. He's a noted historian who studied Gandhiji for several years. When I asked him about how Gandhiji preserved his mind space when the world was clamoring for his attention, this is what he had to say.
Now, spinning is an activity in which you are, of course, doing labor. You are breaking down the caste barriers via, you know, banya spinning. In fact, in one of his court appearances, he says that there's a caste because you have to say he's a farmer and weaver, right? So he wants, and it's, you are spending time with yourself, you know, spinning is also, and of course then silence, walking is another activity in which you're like you have whatever you call it, slow food and slow this, right? So it's, so I think the day of silence that he adopted.
If you want to listen to this piece, you could go to Nugget 39.09, titled Inner Journey, in my conversation with Ramachandra Guha. If you find the content purposeful, please rate and review on iTunes or whichever platform on which you're getting the podcast, whether it's Google Podcast Player, Spotify, Savan, or anything else. If you want to browse through content by a specific theme, say mindfulness, you might want to go to the curated playlist section of the playtopotential.com website. There, specific nuggets are organized by themes that you might be curious about. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Rich Fernandez.
And just a quick comment on, you know, dealing with, you know, meditation or even building the muscle of attention in the digitally, let's say, stimulated world we live in. What are some of the, again, what do you see people do in effectively sort of leveraging the upside of digital while protecting themselves from the downside of digital, if I may use the term?
Well, there are specific ways that people manage or mismanage their attention. So the digital world sucks our attention. It absorbs us. And I don't mean to say that in a bad way. There are tremendous benefits from our information economy. But if we let it be unbridled, it's sort of like eating a delicious feast but never stopping to eat, right? You kind of become overfed and can grow a little sick. And so it's really about managing attention. I like to say it's actually an attention economy where, you know, we have to parse out our investment of attention prudently. Think about it like a portfolio, a financial portfolio. You want to balance your investment prudently. And so you want to allocate time that is offline. You want to compartmentalize time. So I never take out my phone, for example, almost never take out my phone when I'm interacting with my son, who's 12 years old. But that has been true for me, you know, for a very long time. Now, once in a while, I'll get a ping, you know, and, you know, if I have a sense it's a working, something urgent is happening at work, I will check it. But there are kind of set times in which I check. And that's not to say that I'm offline for huge amounts of time. But when I'm offline, I'm really offline. At dinner with the family, the phone is not on the table or anywhere near where notifications can distract me. I think it's really about managing your attention and being and compartmentalizing effectively. And believe me, I'm online sporadically when I'm home from work throughout the evening because I have a job where I do have to monitor. But then I definitely cut off at a certain time as well, usually asleep by, let's say, about or in bed by about 10, and I'm not on my device anymore until after my meditation in the morning.
Got it. Yeah. Now, clearly, the sense I get is unless we draw hard lines, if we just let osmosis, then it's just going to suck the rest of the attention. So that point's well taken.
Yeah.
And moving to mindfulness, in the book, Meng talks about listening, looping, and dipping. And I found those three terms interesting in the context of mindfulness. Could you elaborate on this for the listeners on what do you mean by these terms in the SIY context?
Oh, yeah. So it's very simple. So listening is what was said, and just listening to what was said. Looping is playing back what you thought was said. Literally, Deepak, if you said something right now, like you just asked me, what is looping and dipping and listening in the context of the book? Is that what I heard you ask me? Right. So I'm playing back to you just to confirm that I did understand what you were saying. Because oftentimes we listen not to understand, but to provide our own solutions or drive our own agenda, right? And so what we're saying with mindfulness and listening is, first of all, listen to what's actually being said, loop it back to the person to confirm you heard it, you could simply ask, what I heard you say is such and such. And dipping is something yet again, which is what you heard, that what you think they felt when they said it. Because beneath the content of what's being said is oftentimes a perception or a feeling. And sometimes you want to get at that, right? So let me give you an example. Someone recently said to me, who I work with, said to me, well, the reason the metrics went that way at that point in time was simply because we had a reorg. So it's just a bad state of affairs. So what they said was, we had a reorg, it's a bad state of affairs, right? And so I said, wait, so are you saying we had a reorg and you feel like, and it was a bad state of affairs? Is that what you're saying? Yes. Okay. So what do you feel about that? Because it seems to me you're pointing to that as some sort of root cause. So tell me, like, what is your sentiment about that? Right. Mm. And they were frustrated and they felt like they had been disempowered by this reorg. And that became the root of discussion. And that was the dipping piece. So I wasn't just working at the level of pure content, because there's a person who's saying those words. And if you dip into what that person's experience of the actual situation is, you dip, you can learn a lot more. And that is a form of emotional intelligence. And that's something we teach in our curriculum.
Very interesting. Very interesting. I want to move to journaling, Rich. And in the book, I found an interesting statistic, right? I think Meng talks about a study where a group of people who were laid off, they wrote to themselves about their feelings for about 20 minutes a day. Mm-hmm. And I don't have the statistics in front of me, but they did much, much better than the non-writing control group in terms of getting the next job.
That's correct.
I think, I'm curious about the notion of journaling. What's been your experience about journaling? And more importantly, you know, what should people write about? How important is it? And also comment a little bit about how does one bake the habit, like we discussed earlier on a couple of other things.
Mm-hmm. So, you're citing some studies by James Pennebaker and others who've, really found that journaling has helped all sorts of outcomes, psychological, but also very tangible in terms of, like, you know, finding new jobs after losing them. And I think part of the factors that lead to that are that when you journal, you're basically capturing and encoding your thoughts about a specific situation rather than letting them basically fester, to use a very untechnical term. And so when you are doing this very concrete exercise of stating how you feel, stating what you hope for, stating your goals, you are really making them very, very clear in your own mind. And I think it really helps navigate towards those positive outcomes. One thing we know also, another bit of neuroscience, is that what they found is that people have a better memory for things they've written down than that which they've typed in a classroom setting. That's been a finding in neuroscience. And what neuroscientists have found is the reason for that is that because we can type faster than we can write longhand. And we could type almost at the speed of what's being spoken. And so basically what we're doing is we're just essentially quickly processing but not encoding what's being said. Okay. And when you write something longhand, like when you journal, you actually have to articulate entire thoughts in your head, and they become encoded in your memory in a much stronger fashion. And so basically you're programming yourself in another sense of the word when you journal. You're programming your brain to perceive a situation, you know, through a certain lens or perspective, and it becomes much more real and concrete. And in some ways you start to live your way into that, if that makes any sense. So what I would say for journaling to get started or to habituate it, make it more of a habit, think about a prompt. Today I feel ... and then just write for 2 minutes without stopping, stream of consciousness. And you can look in, I think the SIY book has some prompts for good journaling prompts that you can use, you know, It's simply things like things that annoy me are, I'm at my best when, I hope that. Just these open-ended questions can really be wonderful ways to start your journaling practice. And just like meditation, you have to do it to experience the benefits.
And what do you see people do in terms of review what's being written? Is that important at all, or even the act of writing itself is good enough? Or do you see people coming back every week or every month to really make sense of what they've written?
It seems like the act of writing itself is the most important piece, but then, you know, reviewing it further encodes it as well. So I think the research had much more to do with the actual act of writing. But what we know is that when people can reinforce that through reading it, so we always ask people to read what they wrote after they've done it in our curriculum. And it really helps bring a lot of clarity. For the listeners, I would just invite you to try that. You don't have to do this extensively, but you know, for 3 or 4 days of a week, for you know, 7 minutes, 5 minutes even each, give yourself a prompt. I'm at my best when, I hope for, and just let yourself write and experiment with this and see what emerges. It might surprise you.
And do you see people picking one prompt and sticking with it across time, or do you pick different prompts at different points in time? Do you have a view on that?
No, I don't have like a consistent. I don't see consistently what people do. What we like to encourage people to do is find the prompt that's most relevant for you at that point in time. So if you're feeling particularly frustrated during a certain period, write about things that annoy you so that you get clarity on those. If you're hoping for a new situation, think about what you know your work or life would be like if it exceeded your expectations in a year. And so that's one exercise I actually do at the beginning of every year. I do that exercise myself. If my life exceeded my expectations in the next 3 years, my life would ... And I just write that. I write that every year at the end of the year as I set up for the new year. So just think about situationally what would be a useful prompt for you and then just get going writing on it.
Got it. No, that's so profound. I think in the busy lives we lead, just stopping to reflect, I think is one of the things that everybody realizes the importance of, but it just, the work crowds out most other things. So points well taken.
Yes.
This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. In my coaching work, when we are trying to drive behavioral change, I often urge the leaders to develop some sort of a journaling habit. I like the distinction Rich makes between writing with a pen and paper versus typing. I also like the phrase Rich uses when he says that by journaling, you begin to reprogram yourself and you act your way into the new version of you. I thought that was really powerful. I asked one of my earlier guests, Vinay Sitapati, the author of the book Half Lion, a biography of Narasimha Rao. When I asked him about what gave Narasimha Rao the ability to process the complexity around him, this is what he said.
And Narasimha Rao's ability to be introspective, to be inward, helped him sift the day into what, you know, or to put it in statistical terms, to be able to sift the signal from the noise. So I think that's the first thing that introspection taught him, that, you know, one is it taught him don't trust anyone except your diary, which is a pretty good skill in politics. Second is that you should be able to sift the signal from the noise. You know, who are the people you met every day? You know, how many people are being honest? How many people are lying? You know, to give you just one example, you know, one of the diary entries which I have in the book is from 22nd May 1991. Right, this is the day after Rajiv Gandhi has been killed near Chennai, and Narasimha Rao, who at that until then had been basically eased out of the Congress and was about to become a monk in a monastery called Kottralam in Tamil Nadu, and was closing his bank accounts, is suddenly realizing that by virtue of being the least ambitious man in the party, he's primed to be Prime Minister of India, right? And the diary shows, 22nd May, he's back in Delhi, he's in 10 Janpath, where Sonia Gandhi and Rajiv used to live. And, you know, pieces of Rajiv Gandhi's body, they're just pieces, they're not the full body, are kept there, and all the congressmen are around the body pretending to cry, some of them actually crying, while actually trying to maneuver to see who would succeed him. And he has this wonderful passage about how Pranab Mukherjee, who was in the boondocks then, but would later recover to become President of India, wheedles up to him and says, "We think you should become Prime Minister, Congress President," which is the proxy for Prime Minister of India. And Narasimha Rao immediately says, I immediately told him that, you know, that it was, you know, that I'm not the right person, right? Knowing full well the kind of person he is. I also gave him the name of N.D. Tiwari for Prime Minister of India, knowing that he was even less likely a candidate than I am, right? And I think the introspection and the diary allows him to do that. It allows him to reflect over the day. You know, otherwise, you know, think of it. Somebody else come, you know, Pranab Mukherjee came up to me and says, maybe you should be Prime Minister of India. I wouldn't stop to ask what's his angle, right? So I think the introspection gave him that ability.
Of the leaders that I've studied, either through my leadership advisory work or at the podcast, if I had to distill what are the 3-4 habits that stand out for these leaders, I'd like to believe that journaling would be one of them. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Rich Fernandez.
One of the other things that struck me in the book was the notion of grasping and aversion. And what struck me was Meng says that this accounts for close to 90% of the suffering. And the related theme that comes up is the notion of meta-distress, feeling bad about feeling bad. So talk to us about what these terms mean and how one could deal with them.
Let me see if I could put this in clear and simple terms. Very often there are the facts, and then there's the story we tell ourselves about the facts. And it's the story we tell ourselves, the narrative that we tell about something that happened that causes us distress. Because often that narrative has to do with, A, how poorly we did. So I'm grasping for, you know, a different outcome that I could have probably done. Or we're pushing away that experience because we feel it's difficult and not something we want to deal with. And when in our curriculum, what we often like to talk about is the ability to shift from this existential experience and narrative where, you know, you're all bad or you're all good or you're grasping or being averse to a situation, to simply allowing yourself to notice that you're experiencing this in your body. Okay. And that sounds a little funny, but let me explain further. What we're really talking about is shifting from an existential state, a perception of an existential situation where, for example, you are a failure. That's a pretty popular one. A lot of people will have that narrative in their head. This happened and I'm a failure. You know, I'm terrible. That is an existential state that you're saying about yourself. And you will experience suffering if you let yourself stay in that state. When in truth, you might have had a setback and you experience emotions as a result of that setback, but those emotions are actually just emotions. In other words, they're just physiological processes happening in your body. The moment you're able to move from that existential state to this experiential process that has to do with the situation, you're able to get a little bit of distance from it. You're able to have one small degree liberated from it so that you could see it happening to you and within you. And it's valid and it's real. And you don't deny or suppress it, but it's having the ability to just notice that this is a process that's moving within you and through you. And it sounds terribly esoteric, but it's actually based on science, because most people start to suffer and tell stories about themselves based on their feelings. But if you look at what a feeling is, an emotion, it's a set of physiological reactions that happen in response to our environment or to thoughts that we have sometimes. And if you see emotion as a process, and you're really able to see that and take that meta perspective or exercise metacognition, then you're able to free yourself a little bit of it from it and navigate it. So let me give you a concrete example, because this might seem like I'm talking about riddles, right? So recently, we did not meet a certain financial benchmark, okay? And I started doing that narrative, like, oh, how did I do this? This is a complete failure, you know? I can't believe that, you know, I missed this particular thing that would have changed everything if we had seen this. And I found myself berating myself, right? And along those lines, until I realized, wait a minute, I'm feeling upset about the fact that this was missed. And I'm having the experience of stress and frustration around it. But it's just an experience that I'm having at the moment. And it doesn't mean that we can't remedy these things. It doesn't mean we can't learn from them. But I'm just at the moment experiencing frustration. So I note it. And in noting it, it starts to diminish somewhat. And I'm not governed by it anymore. I'm not kind of defined by that experience. And my mood state starts to shift actually as well. So I'm not just an angry, grumpy leader because we missed financial targets, but one who's like starting to develop this agility, this ability to learn, this ability to kind of see the next path, see around the corner, and actually look at other solutions. So it's a way to kind of manage yourself, moving from the facts and moving away from the story you tell yourself about the facts and simply dealing with the facts directly. I hope that makes sense to the listeners. It's trying to explain a very complicated concept in a very short amount.
Makes immense sense. It's about sort of looking at things. It's like stepping away from the movie and watching the movie play out, right? Rather than being consumed.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Beautifully said. And by the way, can I just draw a linkage here? Because we started this podcast with you asking me, what is the difference about leadership in Silicon Valley? And this is the very thing I'm talking about. When you're dealing with disruption and you need to be agile, you don't have the affordance of being able to be stuck in frustration and being able to be stuck in, you know, narratives about failed solutions. You need to be agile. And this is very much how we develop those skills.
That's interesting. I mean, you're also even saying agility in terms of how you're thinking about yourself and how you deal with, it's not just agility to business developments, but it's even agility in terms of how we deal with our emotions and situations.
Oh, absolutely. That's actually the bedrock because it actually informs your worldview and how you show up as a leader. So this skill is something that we teach. We call it response flexibility, right? The ability to respond rather than react to challenging situations. And most people in business face challenging situations all the time. But if you're only reacting to them, right, and being very hot and angry all the time, you're not being responsive, actually. You're not being balanced and you're not being clear-headed. And so that's the difference. Being response flexible in the face of challenges and disruptions is a critical skill for business leaders and for technical leaders. And yes, it does very much have to do with your own internal landscape. And like, that's why we call the curriculum Search Inside Yourself, because we believe that to be an effective leader and a thriving person, what more, you need to develop those skills of awareness and self-knowledge and self-management in order to be effective.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. A similar point came up in my conversation with the chess legend Vishy Anand. He talks about how the context changes suddenly when you get to move 40, where extra time gets added, and unless people are present to the moment and readjust their minds, they could end up making big mistakes.
I'll give you one quick example. I would often get to move 40, and move 40 is significant because it's the end of the first time control, which means that you get a fresh amount of time on your clock, and normally your time pressure is over. But a lot of people, the time between move 32 and 40 is so tense, and they're so caught up in it, they're not able to stop. They'll make the 41st move anyway, and especially once upon a time I was very prone to this error. And I was also prone to an error that when I had half an hour and my opponent had 3 seconds, I would try to play fast so that he wouldn't have any time to think. It doesn't take a lot of intelligence to stop yourself and see that if you play fast to not give him any time to think, you're not giving yourself any time to think either.
In a world with rapidly shifting contexts, I guess building response flexibility rather than just reacting might just be a superpower that can make a significant difference in the quality of decisions you make and determine how nimble you are as the context around you changes suddenly. To hear this nugget, you might want to go to my conversation with Vishy Anand, specifically to Nugget 21.05, where he talks at length about how the human mind works at a conscious and a subconscious level and how we can unlock the full potential of the human mind. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Rich Fernandez.
Moving to a different topic, Rich, resilience. You talk about three levels of resilience: inner calm, emotional resilience, and cognitive resilience. And once again, I found it interesting that you'd broken it down into these three. Normally, people talk about resilience at a headline level, but mm-hmm. It was interesting to see these three different levels of resilience. Talk to us about what these terms mean and how we can build these muscles.
Mm-hmm. Well, inner calm is the first thing that we talked about earlier, which is the skill of mindfulness and being able to manage your attention. And so something happens when you're able to direct your attention to the present moment via breath, mantra, whatever you call it, where you become calm, right? And less reactive because you're just simply grounded and focused. So that's the habit of inner calm, is the habit of mindfulness. Emotional resilience happens when you're able to become aware of the emotions that you're having as you're having them. This has a little bit more to do with open monitoring that I was discussing earlier. You're noticing what's arising within you as an emotion, as it's arising in real time. And it allows you then to take that distance that I was talking about, to exercise that response flexibility. Right? When you're aware of your emotions, you're able to manage them. When you're aware of your emotions, you're able to respond rather than react. Now, some listeners might say, well, look, Rich, it's really important to react. I'm in a business where I have to react. And I would say to you, unless you're experiencing an existential threat, like your life is in jeopardy, it's going to always be far more effective to respond rather than react. Because responding doesn't mean going slow.
True.
So let me give you an example to make this really concrete and really, really clear. Have you ever been in an airplane and experienced heavy turbulence?
Absolutely.
You have, right? I'm sure the listeners have too, right? Who do you want in the cockpit in that moment? Somebody who's reacting and just alarmed and on fire, or someone who's calm, competent, clear-headed, and knows exactly what needs to happen and when it needs to happen?
You want Captain Sully. Yeah.
Yes, you want Captain Sully Sullenberg. I've actually met the man. He came to give a talk at Google, and he is that way when you meet him. He is like one of the calmest, most grounded people I know. But what does he say, actually? He says that he trained, and this is, by the way, for the listeners who aren't familiar with Captain Sully Sullenberger, he's the man who landed the jet plane that was flying over New York City. It flew through a flock of geese, so they lost all jet propulsion because the geese flew into the engine and burnt them out. So in the space, I think, of about 3 minutes, he had to make a split-second decision to land the airplane on the Hudson River. It was the only available large open space over New York City. But he thought about this very, very calmly. Okay, so I'd ask you to Google or YouTube it. You'll see the interview with him where he explains it. But how did he do that? He says he trained his whole career for it. He said, I have 30 years as a pilot. And so I just know the routines. I knew what needed to happen, right? And he just calmly proceeded to do that. He didn't react and become overblown or overwhelmed by the situation. And this is why, you know, we talk about emotional resilience as being a key quality of a leader in the digital economy. And then the last piece, Deepak, because you asked me about this, was cognitive resilience. And this is simply your mental outlook. It's very simple. It's one of two things. It's optimism versus pessimism. Mm-hmm. And studies have shown that people that have positive outlook and that are optimistic are people that see possibilities, and they feel agency. They feel like they're able to act against those possibilities and that they themselves can have a positive impact on making those possibilities a reality. That's what an optimist does. Pessimists tend to be people who actually take a disempowered mentality. They often feel like they're victims. They often feel like injustice simply exists and there's very little you can do against it. So why bother even trying? They fall into cynicism. And it's not particularly effective as a leader to be a terrible pessimist because you feel like you can actually, you know, make progress against difficulties. So that's what, and you can cultivate, by the way, cognitive resilience by actually doing things like, you know, expressing gratitude looking at, you know, positive qualities in positive attributes in your life or those around you.
Got it. And you spoke about inner calm, cultivating inner calm, but on the emotional resilience, coming back to what you said about Sally Sullenberger, any observations on how people can cultivate emotional resilience?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is the process of starts with open monitoring and developing that self-awareness, right, of emotional processes that are happening in your body as they're happening. So this is a type of meditation. You can do this as a type of meditation and simply allow your, or read the book or, you know, take one of our programs. We teach you to kind of become aware of thought, feeling, sensation, and just kind of move through those different domains of experience. You could do sight, you could do smell, touch, just notice, go through the categories of experience and just simply notice what is happening for you in that moment. And that will then build the skill of open awareness so that when you do face a situation where you're triggered in real life and have these difficulties, you're immediately aware of what you're feeling. Right?
Got it.
If you can name it, then you can actually manage it. Very much like Peter Drucker said, you have to be able to measure it to manage it. Hmm. Well, in this exercise of emotional resilience, you have to be able to name it to then be able to manage it and to respond to it versus react to it. And if you ask most people, you know, when they're really triggered, when they're really, let's say, pissed off, they can't really explain what they're feeling.
Hmm.
Right. And so the more fluent you become in your own, the emotionally literate you become about your own emotions, your own internal ecosystem, then the more emotionally resilient you'll be able to be. And you develop again that skill by being able to monitor your own experience as you're having it.
Got it. Moving on to a different theme in the book, which really caught my attention, it was Gottman ratio, right? It's a ratio of positive to negative experiences for a long-term relationship to flourish. And I read something like a 3:1 or a 5:1, which sort of says that, you know, one negative experience wipes out three positive experiences, right? Something to that effect. So I'm curious to hear about your take on that and therefore what does it mean in terms of how we influence?
Yeah. Well, let me just reframe that a little bit because it's a little bit more along the lines of we notice negative things in our environment far more readily than we do positive ones. And that's simply because from an evolutionary perspective, we've had to develop what's called this negativity bias.
Hmm.
In other words, we had to assess threats in our environment that could harm us and be really good at doing that at a higher ratio than we could the pleasurable ones. Because the pleasurable ones, we could go without. But if we failed to assess a threat, we could be dead. So if we failed to notice there was a bear, you know, hiding behind that rock, we were dead. If we walked by a blueberry bush, we could find another blueberry bush. The consequences weren't as dire. So our brains became hardwired to notice negative impulses at a rate of about 3 times as much as positive ones. So why does that matter in relationships and in leadership? It's because people are sort of tuning mostly to bad stuff. And so you have to overweight the good. So you almost have to reverse the ratio. You almost have to like do 3 times as many positive things to counteract the negative things that they experience. So, you know, for children, you know, praise, acknowledgement, recognition. Same with employees, right? Like recognition is a critical thing for employees, right? How much recognition do we give as opposed to criticism? How much, praise do we actually give as opposed to performance feedback, right? And so in the context of organizations and teams, it's really critical to have a pretty much a positive working environment, because then that leads to another wonderful and a very important team effectiveness factor, which is psychological safety. Google did a study and they found that the top quality of the most effective teams wasn't that they were geniuses, but that they had a sense of psychological safety with each other.
This they is Project Aristotle, right?
Project Aristotle, correct. Which was named because, you know, Aristotle famously said, we are greater than the sum of our parts, right? So it's not about individual contribution. It's how we work together as a team. And if there is a sense of psychological safety where you can take risks and fail together safely and be supported in having taken a risk and failed and encouraged to continue on. I think Mark Zuckerberg famously said, move fast and break things and learn, right? And that critical piece, learn, right, is what is critical here, because it's really about taking the risk and feeling safe enough to often fail. People often fail in a disruptive innovation economy, and failure has to be okay. I live here in San Francisco, and we have a whole conference called Failure Con. It's all about failures and what we learn from epic failures. It's really funny, but it's actually a really great idea because it allows for failure to be okay.
And back to psychological safety, Rich, what do good leaders do to foster a culture of to foster a psychologically safe culture in the team, in the organization?
They're authentic. So they talk about their own vulnerabilities openly. So they have to model psychological safety as well. They have to model being willing to take risks and failing. And they have to be open and authentic. This is not something that's easy for a lot of leaders. It's not something they teach in business school. It's not something that's even intuitive, because leaders feel like they have to play a role. But think about that term, psychological safety. Whose psychology are we talking about? What is psychology? It's about the human psychological makeup, right? And so it's about being human, which means being authentic and sharing those difficulties and vulnerabilities. Now, you don't have to disclose everything about yourself always, but you have to model what it means to be willing to take risks and to fail and to find another solution and learn. What often doesn't help is negative reinforcement. When you're trying to create psychological safety, fear, anger, you know, these negative emotional states do not promote psychological safety. I'm just going to say that because it's true. People need to feel safe. They need to feel comfortable that they can fail. And if you're using negative reinforcement and fear and criticism, it's not going to promote psychological safety. Now, some people will argue I get results when I manage through those other things that you're calling, you know, negative states. It is very true. You will get results, but they won't be the disruptive breakthrough results, I think, that you're going to see at places like Google, where people are googly, where, you know, it is a challenging environment. It's not like people are taking it easy. I'm not suggesting that psychological safety means everybody's just relaxing. Everybody, to the contrary, everybody's working super hard. They're also taking really big risks and working on really hard problems because they feel safe enough to do that. They don't feel limited and belittled by, you know, this negative environment that's been created. And again, that negative environment will get you some results, but I would argue not sustainably and not next level results like you're seeing in places like Google.
Got it. And just in summary, Rich, just concluding the conversation, this podcast, as you know, is titled Play to Potential, which is actually trying to get people to be reflective about two questions, right? One is where to go, which is how do you navigate your journey? The other is how to grow. Once you've picked your path, then how do you really scale up as an individual and be effective? So in summary, a few words of wisdom from you on how people can play to their potential.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, I'm going to have to say search inside yourself, which means to say develop the skills, because they truly are skills of awareness and self-knowledge, which will ultimately also lead to effective relationships. And the idea that awareness is a skill is critical, because if it's a skill, like all skills, it can be developed. There are habits, there are ways and exercises that you can do to develop your awareness, which will again increase self-knowledge, and then the ability to use that knowledge to grow effective relationships. And in my experience, working with executives and teaching this curriculum, offering this curriculum around the world, really self-awareness and self-knowledge and relationship management are things that are very often neglected in favor of more cognitive and technical skill sets. But like I said before, awareness and self-knowledge and relationship management is a skill, and I would encourage everyone to develop that skill in order to play to your potential, as you like to say.
Lovely. Rich, pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for making the time.
My pleasure, Deepak. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
I hope you found the conversation as rich as I did. Sorry, I couldn't resist that one. But three big takeaways for me in this conversation. First is the notion of agility that Rich talks about. We often talk about how we respond to the VUCA world by being agile and so on. But it was really interesting to hear Rich talk about agility at an individual level when it comes to how we deal with our emotions. That was an interesting take on agility for me. The second insight that stayed with me was the point around meta-attention. We often spend a lot of time thinking about getting the focus right, but I guess working on the guardrails or the steering wheel, the way you see it, is as critical as we hope to move forward in an attention economy that's trying to distract us every step of the way. The third insight that stayed with me was the point he made around journaling and how you can act your way into a new version of you by reprogramming yourself. It was specifically interesting to note his views on writing on a piece of paper versus typing. I hadn't quite thought that the way we capture information would have an impact on the effectiveness of the process. Thank you for tuning in, and I look forward to having you at one of the subsequent conversations at the Play to Potential podcast. To be intimated when I upload new content, you might want to go to bit.ly/signup2p2p. To be precise, it's bit.ly/signup, the number 2, the alphabet P, the number 2, the alphabet P. To access any of the sub-themes that came up in the conversation, such as resilience or mindfulness, please visit the curated playlist section of the playtopotential.com website. You will have perspectives from multiple people on the topics that you care about. If you find the content purposeful, please share with the people that would find this of value and rate and review on the podcast platform where you consume this content. Bye now.